for tonight. Were we going to do a theme song? Were we going to do a special lesson or a special series of lessons? It was suggested, let's take one question that's been asked and that might need a little bit more time, and let's dive into it. And so that's what we're doing with this question, as you see up there. How do you know there's a God? We'll get into that question in just a few moments. But if you still have some questions, tonight is the last night to turn those in because we start on Wednesday. I want to be able to get those on a list and compile those and show the elders those questions so that they know what we're talking about. And so if you do have more questions to give, make sure I get those by the end of tonight. When I was getting ready to propose to Brooke, people would always ask me, and I think they were saying it tongue-in-cheek. Maybe they weren't, I don't know. But how do you know if you're going to say yes? And any of you that's ever asked somebody to marry them, you know there's a sense of nervousness that goes with that, because on one hand, you want to be extremely confident that when you ask that question, they're going to be so overly joyed that they're going to say yes. And then there's something in the back of your mind that says, what if they say no? Now, I felt pretty confident that Brooke was going to say yes. And in the story, she did, in case you were wondering. But there was still something in the back of my mind. What if, for some reason, as she sees me on one knee holding the ring, her light flashes before her eyes and she says no. And there's this sense of nervousness there that goes with that, where you think you know, but do you really know? Now, if I were to ask those of you who are married or who have been in that situation before, if you're engaged or married, how do you know somebody loves you? How would you answer that question? I just want you to think about that for just a moment. Because love is not a physical entity. You can't see love. You can't, you can feel it inwardly, but it's not something you can touch and feel. You can't taste love. You can't hear love. Love is something, it is kind of just a separate entity. It is very hard to describe, but it's not something physical. But I think we all know, most of us know, especially hopefully if you're in a marriage relationship, that you know love is real. But how can you be so sure that you know something is real without having seen it, touched it, felt it, smelled it, hear it? Well, you have to go to evidence. How do I know Brooke loves me? I know by what she says. She tells me. I love you. How do I know she loves me? I know that because she takes care of my three boys. And she cooks me dinner. Sometimes I get home and there's a brand new shirt lying on the bed. So we out shopping and see something and say, I want to get this for you. It's little things, right? And those of you who have that relationship, you know that I don't see love. I can't see it and touch it and feel it, but I know it's there based on the evidence that is there. And when you look at this question of how do you know there's a God, it's very similar to that idea of love. In fact, one person would put it this way. I'm going to insert Brooke's name into this because that's the example I've been using. The cumulative evidence is more than enough to believe that Brooke's love for me is the real deal. That's how they put it. That when you look outside, when you look at all the evidence that is there that we have available to us, it's more than enough to believe that the evidence shows that love is real. There are lots of things that we believe in without seeing or hearing. Take air, for example. All of you believe in it, I know, because you're alive and you're breathing it in right now. But you can't touch it. It's not something I can grab and hold in my hand. It's not something I can see right now, but I know it's there. Because the evidence tells me it is. I know that my lungs are filling with it right now as I speak. I know that all of you are breathing in the air. I know it's there, although I can't see it, because the evidence is there. When it comes to this question, how do you know there's a God? I think it goes without saying, you cannot see God. We cannot touch God. We cannot taste Him. We cannot hear Him as we think of. I just say, there's nothing that I could show you, and this is my preface here at the very beginning of answering this question. There's nothing that I can do tonight with 100% certainty to say, look, here it is, touch it, feel it, much like what Thomas did with Jesus in the Gospels. There's nothing I can do to where you can walk out of here with 100% certainty that there is a God. And so I'm making that very clear tonight. However, what I do want to do tonight is I want to look at the evidence that is there. So where, if we were a jury today, we're putting God on trial, what would our evidence suggest? What would the evidence say? Would we have enough evidence to convict God of being God? Or would there still be doubt? We know that God is spirit. And many find it hard to believe in something that something is real, that they can't see with their physical eyes or hear with their physical ears or touch with their physical hands. But that's what we want to do tonight. We want to see how we know there's a God. I hope that this interests you. This has been one of my favorite topics. Evidences is one of my favorite topics. And so when this question kept coming in, I got really excited to answer this question because it's one of my passions. I'll be very honest up front. I don't know everything there is to know on a lot of the topics we've talked about tonight. I have studied them. I believe what I'm about to tell you tonight. But there's still a lot that I'm learning. I'm not a physicist. I'm not a cosmologist. I'm not an astronomer. But I hope that we have enough evidence to prove that there is a God tonight. First, I want to ask this question. I got interested in, do Americans really believe in God? We live in a predominantly Christian society. And I thought that these were very interesting because there are over 80% of Americans that believe in God. However, that belief varies from person to person. I'll show you what I mean. In some research that was just done this year, back in April, by Pew Research, they showed that out of all the people that do believe in God, only 63% of the people that believe in God are absolutely certain that there is a God. Now, I do want to stop there and say that's a really good number. I wish it was more, obviously, but I do feel like that's a really good number for people who know that there's a God. They're absolutely sure that the God in the Bible is real. However, you start going down this list, and 20% believe in God. However, they're only fairly certain. There's still a little doubt in their mind that all this could really be real. I believe in him, and I'm fairly certain he's real, and I'm fairly certain there is a God, but still not quite sure. And you keep going down the list. 5% believe in God, they're just not too certain. Could be real. Could not be real. I do believe him. But is everything we read about in the Bible, is that true? That is a question we're going to get to in just the next couple weeks in our class, but I'm not too certain about this. 1%, they believe in God, but they really just don't know. Yeah, I believe in him. Maybe it was something I heard growing up. Don't know, though. It's kind of hard to believe in something like a God. You look at what the rest of Americans believe, you have 9% that don't believe in a God at all, and you have 2%, they don't know what they believe. That's called agnostic. Good? Sure? I don't know. Right? And so, that's the breakdown of Americans. Now, I did think something else was very interesting as I continue to look at this research. I continue to look at what these numbers say. I'm not here to pick on young people because you'll see I'm one of them in this category that's coming up next. But we are not the worst category, which is fine, right? All right. Those of us younger than 30, 15% of those who are interviewed who are younger than 30 believe in God and are fairly certain of it. This is an absolute. I left that number out of this slide. But this is, they believe in them and they're only fairly certain. They're not absolutely certain. You have 23% who believe in God and they're still not too certain about it. I believe in it because maybe mom and dad told me I should, but I'm not too certain that God is real. That he's really there. You go on, keep going down the list. 7% believe in God, but they still really don't know. You add all that up, and you have 45% of people younger than 30 who aren't absolutely sure that there's a God. I'm going to add something here. These numbers were on Christians. 45% of Christians younger than 30 aren't absolutely sure that there's a God? Isn't one of the definitions of being a Christian, a follower of Christ, believing that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? How can you believe in Jesus as the Son of God if you're not absolutely sure there even is a God? That's what young people are facing today. They're not sure. I believe in them, but there's that doubt, right? Just like then when we asked our wives to marry us, I know she loves me, but maybe there's still that doubt. Will she say yes? I told you this isn't the worst category. You want to know what the worst category was? Those in the 31 to 45 age group. The number's even larger. You have 17% that believe in God and they're fairly certain of it. Not absolutely, but they're fairly certain of it. 20% believe in God and they're not too certain of it. You have 12% that believe in God and they still maybe don't know if all this is real. They'll choose to believe in them. That brings you just under 15% of people who are not absolutely sure that God is real. Take this half away and all this half, you're not sure. That's a staggering number, isn't it? The reason I brought up this, I know statistics, a lot of people, you start looking at percentages and numbers and you're ready to go to sleep. But the reason I bring this up tonight at the beginning is because I want us to see that if you ask this question, or if you're struggling with this question, if you believe but you're still not sure and you have doubts in your mind, you are not alone. I think it is something that every single one of us at some point have questioned at some time. And you might find yourself in the category of believing, and you're fairly certain of it, but there's still that doubt. Maybe you believe, but you're still not too sure, but you're going to go along with it, because it might be, maybe you've heard it this way, the better alternative, right? Because, as a lot of people like to say, I'd rather take the chance that God is real, and I believe in Him, than not believe in Him, and He's real. And so I'll believe in Him. And so the question is, how do we answer this question? People want evidence. We live in a society that we want proof and evidence to everything. We want a video. We want eyewitness evidence. We want a picture. We want something we can see. We want something we can touch. We want something that is concrete. And again, I told you tonight, I can't give that to you tonight. However, what I can do is give you evidence that suggests there is a God, and that might sway your belief in the right direction. I will also say the number one mistake Christians make to believe there's a God or to prove there's a God, where do they go first? The Bible. Why is that one of the biggest mistakes Christians ever make? To prove God in the Bible.
So look it up.
Who wrote the Bible? What's that? The Holy Spirit, which is what? God. And so if I'm someone who's not quite sure that there is a God, and you're coming at me with a book written by God, you're telling me to believe in somebody who wrote a book telling me to believe in Him. That's crazy. The Bible, I'll also say this, the Bible does not never prove God. The Bible is not a book to prove God. The Bible is a book to teach God. And to teach God's will. To teach God's way. The Bible already assumes God. God is in the very first sentence. In the beginning, God. It already assumes you believe in God. It's just going to tell you more about it. We cannot go to the Bible to prove God. We will look at the Bible tonight a little bit. However, we will find all of our evidence outside the Bible. I'm going to share with you, in the short time I have left, three pieces of evidence. There's a lot more than three. However, I think these three are very convincing. It's three that have convinced me in my studies, and just in my studying of what I've looked at as evidence for God. But I think there's three very concrete pieces of evidence outside the Bible that you can go to prove that there's a God. The number one piece of evidence is just the fact of the existence of our universe. Our universe, as we think of it, is everything known to man. So get outside of the planet Earth, get outside of the Milky Way galaxy, which is our solar system. Go beyond to infinity and beyond, to quote one of my childhood heroes, right? go beyond everything we know. Press your mind to the limits. Think about as far as you can go in space, the great unknown, our universe. To me, the biggest piece of evidence to prove that there's a God. A long time ago, as researchers like Sue and Aristotle, they believed that the universe was eternal. They already had something in their minds that was purpose in their hearts, that when they studied the universe to the best of their ability, they believed it to be an eternal universe. Now, we know that's not true, because we read, again, in the very first few verses of the Bible, that God created it. Okay? So for a long time, people just, who assumed God, assumed that everything we know, it was an eternal place. Until somebody, you might recognize this name, but in 1915, Albert Einstein, he developed the general theory of relativity. This is not a science class, so don't go to sleep yet, right? But when he discovered this theory of relativity, it states that the universe, everything that we know as the universe, is made up of four things. Time, space, matter, and physical energy. Now, before I move on any further, this is so widely accepted. People have tried to disprove Albert Einstein's theory of relativity for years. They have not been able to do it. This is accepted by Christians, accepted by conservatives, by Republicans, by Democrats, by rich, by poor. Do you get the feeling here? Okay, this is an accepted fact. That our universe, everything we know, is developed and made of time, space, matter, and physical energy. He came to the conclusion that all these things, as he was studying all these things, had a beginning point. That everything physical that you and I know has a time where it started. And so he concluded, one of the most brilliant minds of our time, concluded that if this universe is physical, it had to have had a beginning point, a starting point. And so he followed all these factors back to the beginning point, the most singularity point of where it all started. He came to the conclusion that this universe is not an eternal universe. Which proves already what the Bible says, that in the beginning God created, right? So science is now starting to prove what the Bible has already stated. But he followed it back to the beginning point, to the one event where he believes everything pops into being. Now, he calls it the Big Bang. We'll come back to this in just a moment, because so many Christians like to discredit the Big Bang because it has to do with dinosaurs. What happened to the dinosaurs in the Big Bang theory? Dinosaurs exploded, and you wouldn't need to know. Well, the Big Bang is a little different than what maybe you learned growing up. Albert Einstein said there was something that started it all. He started calling it the Big Bang. A lot of scientists have tried to disprove all these theories by Einstein and all of his equations, but they've all failed. The more science researches what Einstein figured out in 1915, the more they realized he was right. In fact, in 1929, some of you may have heard about this, Edwin Hubble and his Hubble telescope discovered that the universe is actually expanding. And what that means is, I want you to think about this for a minute. All of you have blown up a balloon before, right? I almost brought a balloon in, and I thought one of the kids would probably, drive their parents bonkers with the balloon. Okay, but if I start blowing up a balloon, what Hubble and his telescope found when it was sent out into space and started taking pictures and sending them back, found out that our universe was like a balloon. Where it's constantly, with every breath, the balloon is constantly getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Well, what scientists started to do when they started putting Albert Einstein's theory with Hubble's theory of the universe constantly expanding, they said, what if we hit the rewind button? And you went back to the very beginning of when this all happened, how this all got started. Because that's the question. How do you know there's a God? Who started all this? It had to have had a starting point, science says. So how did this all start? Let all the air out of the balloon now. And it goes back to one singular moment where all you have really is nothing. Now listen to what Genesis chapter 1 says. Genesis chapter 1, the first few verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void. And there was darkness on the face of the deep. The Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. First two verses, we have God when there's nothing else. What is not present in the first two verses is time, space, matter, or physical energy. The very things Albert Einstein said make up the very existence of this universe. It's not there. But, verse 3, then God said, let there be light. What's the very next part of that verse say? And there was light. What does that sound like to you? What did Albert Einstein conclude? That if you go back far enough in history, everything had to start somewhere. He called it what? A Big Bang. Let me read this again. God said, let there be light, and there was light. What does that sound like to you? Call it what you want. We shy away from the term Big Bang because of some scientific method that disproved God, right? That's what we've been told and taught for so long. But I say the more science digs into it, the more it matches up with exactly what the Bible is already teaching. We might not call it a Big Bang in the Bible, but God said, let there be light, and there was light. Have you ever seen something explode or bang into existence? You ever seen a grenade go off? I haven't personally, but I've seen video of it. Have you ever seen slow motion of a gun firing? You hear that bang. What you don't see with the naked eye is what? Light. But you see it in slow motion. You put that gun, someone firing a gun, a little spark of light. What science was starting to figure out in the early 1900s is that this universe is not eternal. Had to be started by something. How does this prove there's a God? The universe had a starting point. Something has to start. Science has figured out that things do not exist without a cause. If it began to exist, something had to cause the existence. It's kind of the old story of the watchmaker, right? You don't have all these parts of a watch that you can lay on a table and just time and circumstance. All those pieces of the watch would fit together to make a functioning watch. No, something had to put the pieces there. Something has to put the watch together to make a functioning watch. Well, same with the universe. Something had to start it. Something had to put it there. Einstein said, the universe, by definition, is time, space, matter, and physical energy. So the cause of the universe must be something beyond time, space, matter, and physical energy. And again, this isn't a science class. I'm not going to get into what all four of those things are, because that would bore even myself. Sorry if you're a science teacher. However, it is important to understand that if science has concluded that our universe is made up of these four things, whoever started it has to be beyond those things. They cannot be limited by time if they create time. They cannot be limited by space if they created space. They cannot be limited by matter if they created matter, and so on and so forth. Now let's talk about this. How does the Bible describe God? The Bible describes God as always present. Space doesn't apply to him. Always present. Our God, as we just read about in the first two verses, before there was matter, before there was light, before there was anything, it was void and dark, there was God. Before time began, in the first chapter of the book of Genesis, there was God. God is beyond time. God is all-knowing. He's always present. He's eternal. God is spirit. God is powerful. You take all those things that science says, whoever created this universe has to be outside those things. The Bible describes God as exactly what science says is needed to create a universe. And the Bible was written thousands of years before science figured any of this out. already answered this question, but isn't that how the Bible describes God? The Bible described it long before Einstein figured any of this out. Even Richard Dawkins, some of you may know him, he's one of the most well-known atheists of our time who doesn't believe in God. He said there could be something incredibly grand and incomprehensible and beyond our present understanding. Even he had gotten so deep into his studies, but he is such a staunch atheist that he won't admit there's a God, but he did say there could be something incredibly grand and incomprehensible that is beyond our present understanding. To me, it sounds like an admission without truly admitting that there is a God. Let me just, because I know that's a lot, let me just summarize that first point in the book, the first point of evidence. What science has found is whatever begins to exist, it must have a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe must have a cause for existence. It's pretty simple to understand. The attributes that were found out to make this universe into existence are the same attributes of God. Eternal, all-powerful, all-knowing, always present. The cause of the universe must be God. Can I prove it to you with 100% certainty? But if you gave this evidence to any jury in the court of law, I think there's enough evidence to suggest that the God of the Bible was responsible for the beginning of this universe. Another piece of evidence that I think is very telling of whether or not there is a God is something called the just-so universe. This also, you might have, if you're interested in any of this at all, you might have heard it called the Goldilocks universe, the finely tuned universe, anything along those lines. The Goldilocks universe is because you all know the story of Goldilocks and the three bears. One was too hot, one was too cold, one was just right, just so. One was too big, one was too small, one was just right, or just so. Well, that's this theory of what our universe is. It is just so. It is perfect. That when you look at the world that we live in, it's just a complex world. Science is always figuring out something new. There's just so much that goes into our months and our days and our years, our minutes and our hours, the sun, the moon, the stars, our world. When you look at this universe we live in, it's just, it's amazing. And you look at this planet, and there's just an incredible array of life, and there's this beauty in nature, and all these things that exist. Now, you will have some people who will get into, in just a couple weeks, that will explain all this by chances of evolution. However, the more science has also found when they study this, science is now telling us that all these complexities of our world appear to be so precisely balanced that it's next to impossible that all this just happened. Something had to have aligned it like this. In fact, the more that scientists have studied our universe, they have discovered that there have to be 50 constants that must be just so, or just right, in order for life to be possible anywhere in the universe. And what I mean by that is there are certain things, and I'm just going to give you one example, like gravity. Gravity has to be just right. Just so. Not just on the planet, but in the universe for life to exist in a single spot. If it is off, now I wrote this down because I wanted to quote it exactly. If gravity is off by 1 in 10,000 billion billion billion, then life would be impossible. You know, that's a decimal, a lot of zeros, and a one. And if gravity is off by that much, I can't put my fingers any closer together to illustrate this. If it is off by that much, it would be impossible for life to be here on Earth. That's one of the 50 constants that they have found that need to be in place. There is no question. If one is missing, you cannot have 49, you need all 50. And if one is missing, there can be no life. On top of that, that's our universe. On top of that, they've also seen that there has to be at least, because they're still finding something, more science digs and studies, there a planet needs at least 24 different constants in order for life to exist. There has to be the right amount of mass. gets into gravity and how things pull and how big something is. It has to be a planet. It has to be orbited by a large moon. It has to have a magnetic field. It has to have an oxygen-rich atmosphere. It has to be orbiting a G2 dwarf star. That's just a very smart way to say the sun, right? All these things have to be in place. Those are just a couple of 24. That if it is not in place, they will not even look for life on that planet. And yet, here we are. In the infinitely known universe, they have only found one place where all this is possible. Thousands of years after we read in Genesis chapter 1 that God made all this possible. He spoke into existence. That He made the sun, the moon, and the stars. That He made the people. Don't even get me started. That's another evidence of God that we're not even going into today. But don't even get me started on the complexity of our human system. I think there's more constants that have to be in a human and even in our universe that they found for life to happen in our body and to keep us alive. But here we are. And yet people will say that all this happened because something happened at the right place, at the right time, and life happened. The probability of these factors converging, all at least 74 of these constants converging, is so small that there are many cosmologists and astrophysicists that are now admitting it's more reasonable to believe that the divine designer was involved than to assume it all happened by chance. This isn't something you'll read in the papers or you'll see on TV because it blows everyone's theory that there's no God out of the water. But you have the smartest minds in our country and in our world all coming to the realization that it's more probable to believe that a divine designer was involved than to assume all this happened by chance. Paul Davies, he's a physicist and cosmologist of today. He says, "I cannot believe that our existence in this universe is a mere quirk of fate. We are truly meant to be here." As someone in the field who studies this on a daily basis, this is not just a quirk of fate. We are meant to be here. Again, can this prove with 100% certainty that there is a God? No. But start putting all the evidence together, and I'm liking my odds in the courtroom, showing that there is a God. The last piece of evidence, and then the lesson will be yours tonight. Oh, I forgot I put those in there last minute. I did want to give us some Bible references to look at very briefly. In Psalm chapter 19, verse 1. As you look at the universe that you and I have and that God has created, in Psalm chapter 19, verse 1, David writes there, "The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows His handiwork." Again, biblical writers, thousands of years before science figured it out, already knew. The heavens are declaring the glory of God, the firmament shows His handiwork. In the book of Isaiah, and in chapter 40, it says there in verse 25, "To whom then will you liken me? Or to whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things. Who brings out their host by number? He calls them all by name. By the greatness of His might and the strength of His power, not one is missing." In verse 28, it says, "Have you not known, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the Creator of the ends of the earth, neither faint nor weary." His understanding is uncertain. Those are just two examples of the hundreds we can go to where the Bible already declares God is the Creator of this perfect, awesome universe. Okay, now evidence number 3. It's called our morally good universe. Now this gets into a little bit more of who you and I are as people. But I want you to consider something very briefly for a second. On what basis do you consider something good or evil? We know that there are some unspeakable evils in this world. And when you see something or when you hear something on TV about something going on, whether it's in this country or another, we say that's evil. We know that it's bad. It's morally bad. And we have other things. It's just they're morally good. Like when someone donates money to charity, or you help an old lady cross the street, or whatever it is. They're just good things that we all understand. That's a good thing to do. Now, those are basic examples. But let me ask you this question now. Where did you get that mindset that something is good or bad? And that's really the root of what this piece of evidence is talking about. Atheists are hard-pressed. They're having a difficult time trying to provide an answer for the existence of objective moral values. Let me tell you what I mean by that. There are certain things that you and I have within us, that have already been placed within us, that are just objective moral values. And what that means is, they're basic moral principles that everybody has. It doesn't matter who you are. Now there are, I will preface some things I'm about to say here, there are some people who will disagree with this, that do think murder is okay, that do think things like this are okay, but I will say that a vast majority of people will believe things like murder. And my parents never sat me down when I was growing up and said, okay, Kevin, it's time for us to have a murder talk. Did anyone get that talk? If so, well, maybe you should come to my office this week and we'll have another talk. I never got a rape talk. I never got a bigotry talk. I never got a racism talk. Those are things that maybe I made mistakes. Maybe I said a racist thing before in my life. I didn't know what I was saying because I was young and hadn't been taught yet. But as you grow, there's just something in you that realizes, hey, some of these things, they're morally accepted as not good. Stealing. Murder. Some of those different kinds of things. However, there's also relative principles. And what I mean by that is there are certain things that are not placed within us where we just know this is right or wrong. Let me give you some examples. Some relative principles are cultural habits and principles. Like please and thank you. A morally good thing to do? Absolutely. To say please and thank you. But that's not something that as you grow up, there's something within you that realizes, maybe I should start saying please and thank you. Right? Parents of young children, we know, we teach our kids. The South is huge on this next one. Ma'am and sir. I can't tell you how many times I've been called sir. I feel like I won't say a number, so I don't want to feel that how I feel. But, you know, that's, you know, newsflash, that's a cultural thing. The whole country, the whole world does not use the term ma'am and sir. In fact, I got reprimanded at work one time in California because I called somebody ma'am and she said, I'm 43, I'm not a ma'am. Sorry. It's cultural. In some cultures, that's wrong. In some cultures, things like bowing. How many of you bow to each other when you came in here? Well, we don't do that in our culture. In some cultures, that's a sign of disrespect if you don't bow when you enter the room and greet somebody. Or shaking with your left hand. I'm left-handed. More natural for me to more reach out with my left hand. But you know, in some cultures, not to be graphic, but I'm doing this to prove a point, not to be graphic, we don't think anything of it in this country. In fact, there are some people who will reach out a left hand. However, that is the biggest sign of disrespect in some countries because the left hand is the one that you use when you go to bat. So the difference is this, and this is why this is so important if you're sticking with me. There are some things that are taught culturally, they're relative, depending on where you are. And then there are other things that really expand what we think of as race and class and region. And that is Murder is wrong here in Athens, Alabama, and it's wrong where I grew up in California, and it's wrong across every country in this world. Do people do it? Yes. But it's understood by a vast majority that's wrong. It's understood that things like rape, wrong. And go down the list, there's a lot more. Those objective principles, those moral principles, they're wrong. If a culture started throwing babies off the cliff, we wouldn't say, well, it's just their culture. We would say that is morally unacceptable. If a country started locking people up of a different color, we'd say that's wrong. If a country started taking people, and just because of the color of their skin or because of their religious affiliation, started mass murdering them, like we've seen in some of your lifetime, we know that is wrong. The question with this, what makes it wrong? Who put it in your heart to realize that there are just some things they don't believe in the law? I don't need a murder talk. There's something already in us that knows that that is wrong. Objective principles are universally understood throughout time, race, and religion. Now, again, there are some religions, consider yourself a religion, that might, or whatever it is, that might go outside the norm of objective principles. But relative principles are man-made and only accepted by certain societies or groups. Where do we get this idea of right and wrong? How come it doesn't matter what color we are, it doesn't matter where we're from in this world, we can all look at certain things and say, we know that's not acceptable. Turn with me to the book of Romans. Did you know the Bible has an answer for that? In Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2, start reading with me in verse 14. It says, for when Gentiles, those were people, remember, who did not believe in God. For when Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature, do the things in the law. These, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the work of the law written in their hearts. Their conscience also bearing witness in between themselves, their thoughts accusing. Or else, you notice what Paul said there? The Gentiles, the people that don't even believe in God, when they obey the law, not because they have the law, because it was written where? It was already written in their hearts. Who put it there? Who wrote it there? Paul's assumption is God. That God has put something in each and every one of us. It doesn't matter if we believe in God or not. There's a law in our heart. That objective, moral law. When something is wrong, it's wrong. It doesn't matter if you believe in God or not. And this is one of the biggest stumbling points for atheists. People who don't even believe in God. Because they will even live by a moral code to say murder is wrong. And when you ask, well, who told you it's wrong? They would be very careful not to admit that there's a higher power. Put it in their heart. Otherwise, it might sound too much like these words here. I want you to think that I put this up. Came to me, but we've experienced that. There was no law given yet at the point of Cain and Abel. Cain killed his brother. The natural instinct was to do what? Hide the body. Why? To our knowledge. Could there have been? Yes. But to our knowledge, there was no law given to Adam and his children yet, thou shalt not murder. But I believe it was a universally accepted, objective, moral law to know that when you took the life of somebody else, it was wrong. And even Cain himself had to hide that body. And not only did he hide the body, he tried to hide it when God said, where's your brother? He says, I'm my brother's keeper. He knew in his heart. the summary of this. If God does not exist, then objective moral values don't exist. That means we can live by whatever law we want. If there is no God, live by, do whatever you want to do. Heaven or hell doesn't matter at that point. Eternity doesn't matter at that point. Live however you want to live. But yet even atheists, as I said just a moment ago, have trouble getting around this. We can't just live however we want to live. There are objective moral values. They exist. Which tells me, in the case of what I read in the Bible and being able to answer some of the things we've already answered, God has to exist. I'm giving you three pieces of evidence. I don't think either one of these pieces of evidence is enough to say with 100% certainty that there's a God. Again, we can't touch it. Can't feel it. Can't taste it. Can't smell it. Whatever it is. But I think, as we conclude here, this is our last slide for tonight. I think God is like the virtue of love that we open this up with tonight. We cannot see it directly, but we can see evidence for it all around. And the more you dig deeper, the more you study what science has to say. For so long, Christianity and science were at total odds with one another. And I believe the more you study what science is having to say now, you'll see the more they are agreeing with what the Bible is already telling. But it's like love. You can't see it. But you know it's there when you see the evidence for it. One person would put it this way. The cumulative case for God's existence is more sufficient for an open-minded person to believe that He is really dead. If someone is really, truly searching for answers, in other words, if someone is open-minded enough to even have a possibility that God is there, there is more than enough evidence to believe that God is real. The reason we started with this question is because this one question is going to drive us forward for the rest of the class. If we cannot believe and trust that God is real, that He plays an active part in our lives, we cannot answer some of the questions as we go forward. Some things like that will be very difficult to talk about, but some questions you ask, why does God allow evil? Why does an all-powerful God care about me? What about evolution? What about the Scriptures? Can we trust what God is trying to tell us? If you don't believe in God, none of those questions matter. That's why we started with this one tonight. And I'll be free to admit, this was a tough question. You may not be convinced, but I hope that what tonight did was give you just enough evidence to maybe go study more, to ask more questions. It is great to ask questions. We'll talk about that on Thursday night. And if I've confused you and you have no idea what we talked about tonight, come talk to me. Again, I don't have all the answers, but I can either help you or point you in the direction where you can't get answers. Because if we don't believe in God, how can we believe in God's Son? How can we believe in God's Son? How can we believe in eternity? It all hinges on whether or not there is a God. I hope that you can move out of the category, if you were there, to say, I believe in God, still not sure. I hope that one day you can get there with 100% certainty, absolute resolution in your heart that there is a God and He wants you in heaven. This was not a lesson designed to bring anyone to the gospel. It was designed to bring you closer to God, however. And what God says, if we want to spend eternity with Him, we are going to believe in His Son and be baptized for the remission of our sins. If you need to do that now, you can come forth and stand. Let me sing.
Son is called sweet.